Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
This variant is insubordinate, stubborn, unpredictable.
You need the God of Mischief.
Where you go, it's just death, destruction, the literal ends of worlds.
Okay. Change. Change. Maybe Loki wants to mix it up. Is that possible? He can change.
I am Loki, and I am burdened with glorious purpose.
Hello and welcome to the preview episode of Still Watching Loki. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair special correspondent Anthony Bresnikan.
We are back, Anthony, back in the Marvelverse.
You know, it hardly seems like we left. It was just a short time ago, but it is nice to be back. You know, those fallow periods in between shows, I miss you.
Oh, I miss you too. I'm so excited that we're doing this little preview episode. Obviously, we are doing this in advance of the premiere of Loki, which will drop next week. And going forward, we're doing Loki just a smidge differently than we did the last two Marvel series, WandaVision and Falcon and the Winter Soldier. Previously, Anthony, if you might recall, we would desperately wake up at the wee hours of the morning on a Friday and try to crash a podcast together, right? Do you remember that?
Faint memories? I do. Yeah, happy memories? That's not such a bad thing. But
I'm giving us all a little bit of a break this time. So episodes of Loki will drop at midnight Tuesday Pacific time. So, you know, folks can either watch it then if they're, you know, maniacs. Or wake up on Wednesday, watch it anytime during the day on Wednesday, the Wednesday evening. Loki Wednesdays are a whole thing on social media now, etc. We will have this episode for you on a Thursday. So you will get this from us on a Thursday morning, early, something like that. I don't know. We're just giving ourselves a little bit more breathing room. And that way, what's great about that is that the podcast can be a little bit more interactive in that you guys can email us as you always have, but you can email us about the episode we're discussing. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. So that is our new plan. Anthony, any comments, questions, or concerned about the new plan?
I have no concerns, but I think, we're trying to give people a chance to watch it and actually absorb our conversation about it once the majority or a large group of folks at least have a chance to sit down and watch it. I know the diehards are there at midnight, to check out each Marvel chapter, but you know, some people take a little longer the next day to catch up, and so we'll be there for you to discuss this after you guys get through it.
All right. So please do take advantage of the email. We love getting your emails. Stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We got a couple email questions about, you know, for this preview episode about what to prepare for the show. So we're going to do some basic prep right now, Anthony and I. And obviously, sorry, when Loki kicks off in earnest, when episode one drops next week, our colleague Richard Lawson will be back in his role chatting with me the first half of the episode. So Richard's just taken a little Mayor of Easttown break this week, but he'll be back. He'll be back with us next week. So Anthony and I are going to do some sort of basic bare bones breakdown of what, you know, what Loki is, what to expect. Then we have a great interview, and I say great because of him, not because of the interviewer who was me, but a great interview.
Oh, come on. You're a great interviewer. You do great conversations. You. I'll hype you. I'm your be your hype man.
Thank you. With the show head writer, Loki head writer Michael Waldron, and we'll get into it in a second why Michael is especially exciting to talk to right now in the realm of big franchises, but he had some great, really interesting stuff to say that got me extra excited for a show I was already excited for. So that will come in the middle of the episode, and then Bresnikan and I are going to get a little extra nerdy, a little granular, like we like to, maybe a little forward looking about how Loki's going to affect everything. So you know, if you want that, you can stick around after the interview for that. Does that sound good, Anthony Bresnikan?
Sounds good to me.
All right. Do we want to let's start with who are the main creative forces behind Loki? What do you know, Anthony?
Well, we have the writer, Michael Waldron, and it's directed by Kate Herron. I think it's interesting. They have they tend to pair a writer, like a showrunner and a director. So these are kind of like mini movies rather than TV shows where they hand back and forth different, you know, different directors. And, you know, I know there's a writer's room, but I like the sort of singularity of vision that they, as much as any Marvel movie is, that they bring to these shows. Is Kate Herron sticking with every episode?
She is. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Yeah. So that's like before.
Yeah. So I know Kate's work from the great show Sex Education, a great Netflix series that folks should check out. And yeah, I think it's interesting also, not only on each of these shows have we gotten a head writer, they're not really calling them showrunners, and Mike Waldron in our interview kind of got into the difference between a regular showrunner and what Marvel's calling sort of their head writer position, right? And Adam Beavery, by the way, has an excellent piece on Variety about sort of the idea of these Marvel shows not having a showrunner per se. Oh, that like
my old EW colleague Adam Beavery. I like him; he does good work.
Adam's great. Yeah, this idea that they have a head writer and a director for these first three shows, WandaVision, Falcon, Winter Soldier, and Loki, and they've been alternating. WandaVision had a female head writer and a male director for all the series. Falcon, Winter Soldier had a male head writer, female director for all the episodes. And this is another male head writer, female director for all the episodes. So I just like that they're sort of doing that kind of pairing. Whether consciously or not, I like it. And so, yeah, so that's Kate. I'm really excited for Kate. We'll be talking to her later in the season. But Michael Waldron is a Rick and Morty writer and also created the show Heels. It's debuting on Stars. It's about pro wrestling. You'll hear him talk about that. But also, what do you know about Michael Waldron going forward in the world of Disney, Anthony?
I don't know. You tell me. I'm drawing a blank.
Okay, so Waldron got hired to do this show. Then, before Loki was even done,
I know
he got
in a different universe we're going into as well.
Well, right? That's
why
I said
you're
Disney.
Alluding to. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was very Marvel and Doctor Strange. Okay, so you fill it. Where are we going first with Marvel and Doctor?
Right.
Strange?
So he's doing Doctor Strange. He was tapped to, you know, once they decided to not go with the writer and director of the first Doctor Strange film, Marvel tapped Sam Raimi to direct and Michael Waldron to write Doctor Strange 2 in the Multiverse of Madness, which we talked about a lot when we talked about WandaVision. So he wrote that. So he hopped directly from Loki. Loki wasn't even done yet. And he hopped directly from Loki to working on that. And then Feige was so impressed with everything that he's done on Loki and on Doctor Strange that then what did Kevin Feige do? Anthony Bresnikan.
Oh. Kevin Feige took some money and went to make a Star Wars. He's developing a Star Wars show. or Star Wars movie. I believe that's the current status of it. Mm-hmm. And Michael Waldron was liked so much, he got invited to play with those toys.
So he's going to be writing on that film. So that's the Waldron, the rapid ascension of Michael Waldron, which is why he's such an interesting person. Also just like a really nice guy and really smart about story, a great person to talk to. So we have him on the show. We're really excited about that.
He was a writer's assistant on Community, I believe.
He was.
Sitcom, he was. Which the Russo brothers were deeply involved with. So he's got connections to them.
Yeah.
Everybody graduated from that community college and went on to big things.
I don't think you overlapped with the Russos at Community. I think they were ships in the night, but
were they?
I will say, this is dropping the same time that I've got like a big profile on Michael Waldron that's going to be on VF.com. I talked to Dan Harmon about the fact that like Kevin Feige keeps plundering the Harmon treasure chest, right? He took the Russos, took Waldron when they were just about to make Waldron the showrunner for Rick and Morty. They plucked mm-hmm. Waldron out of there. They took Jeff Loveness, who is another Rick and Morty writer, and he's writing the new Ant-Man film. So, like, and when I talked to Kevin Feige, he said he was a big Rick and Morty fan. So I think he's just sort of peeking over the fence at Harmontown, seeing who he can pluck. And I asked Dan Harmon, I was like, would you fight Kevin Feige in the street for all the people that he's taking? He's like, well, I would, except Kevin Feige's so nice. He would just be like, oh, I think it's great you're fighting me. That's great. I think this is awesome. So he's like, what's the point? So I talked to Harmon and Jeff Loveness about Waldron and sort of his big rise here. So that's over on VF.com right now as you listen to this podcast. So that's, I mean, I'm already excited. We haven't even gotten
good
into
provenance.
The show.
I mean, it's a sign of things, a nice Loki is a nice prologue of things to come.
Yeah, exactly. Something that Nate Moore said when we talked to him for Falcon and the Winter Soldier, one of Marvel's longtime producers, was that WandaVision, Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and Loki were the first three shows that they brought to Bob Iger at Disney when they were saying, like, we want to launch Disney Plus and these are our first three pitches. And they were sort of surprised that their first three pitches got the green light. But I think the thing that Nate Moore said at the time was like, well, if you've seen Tom Hiddleston at Comic-Con, you know that it's like irresistible to build a show around him. Brez, were you at that Comic-Con when Tom Hiddleston took the stage as Loki?
Oh, I was. So there's like a strobe effect, and then he comes out in costume.
Yes.
And essentially recreates his scene from the first Avengers, where he makes what's that basically like wants to rule over a group of people. You know, when he stands in front of that crowd and is like, kneel. And they all kneel except for one man. So he kind of came out and trash talked the audience. It was very WWE, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
And he was the heel. And now he's the hero of this story, or at least the protagonist.
Possibly. We'll see. And then last thing I'm going to say, sort of like big bones premise of this, is that we asked Michael Waldron, my favorite question to ask these head writers, like, what's the one comic book recommendation that you would give to someone before they dive into your show? This paid off really well for us with Falcon and the Winter Soldier, right? Because Malcolm Spellman recommended The Truth, which was the Isaiah Bradley comic. And that wound up being one of our favorite parts of the show was the Isaiah Bradley stuff.
Red,
right?
White, and Black, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Journey into Mystery by Kieran Gillen, not to be confused with Karen Gillen. Kieran is K-I-E-R-O-N, Gillen, G-I-L-L-E-N. Journey to Mystery is a hard thing to sort of narrow down, but the run we're looking at specifically here is 622 to 636, and it is about Kid Loki.
Yeah.
I dug into this comic before we started. Anthony, did you get a chance to look at it yet?
I did, yeah. And it's, yeah. I think, you know, the comics never are a one-to-one correlation, right, with the movies, but you can kind of see this. It's like a post-Ragnarok type of story, if you think of it that way. Asgard has been destroyed. Loki has been destroyed, but he exists in these other forms. And those other forms are kind of falling back into familiar patterns, I guess we'd say.
Yep. I mean, Kid Loki is interesting, and there may or may not be literally a Kid Loki in this series. We're going to talk about that in a second. But you'll hear from Waldron about like why that comic was interesting to him. But like, as you say, it's never a one-to-one, right? But it's more like, what is the essence of this comic that has interested these writers, right? They didn't do the Truth, Red, White, and Black comic for Falcon Winter Soldier, but the story of Isaiah Bradley was interesting to them. So like, what is it about Kid Loki? And like I said, you'll hear Waldron talk about it. But I really enjoyed reading this comic once you get used to the like Thor font that they use in all the Thor comics.
It's a weird one. It starts off with a lot of bursting creatures too, which I think is like, okay, once you can get through that, then you're in a good place. But
it's pretty fun. Yeah.
What struck me about it is it's about a character who's struggling to be good, like struggling to be different. Like, how much can you actually change? And I know this is a divisive movie, but it reminded me a little bit of Joker. The Todd Phillips film with Joaquin Phoenix, in that there's a character you kind of empathize with, but then kind of don't. And then it's a story that's really pushing you away from the central figure, as they push away from their better instincts. You know, there's a scene early on where the specter of the deceased Loki arises after a series of riddles are solved, and tells Kid Loki, like, I did all this. I allowed myself to succumb in order. The only person I would do that for is myself. So I think it's kind of like again, not to draw another franchise into this, but like a Darth Vader, like, join me and we will rule the galaxy. Like, you are me, I am you, we are all together. Cuckoo-ka-joop, right? Like, it's and I find that compelling anytime the protagonist is like, you have a destiny, and that destiny isn't necessarily one that you want, but it is in you. And I think all people carry that with them. Like, we carry good and bad potential within us. And so that internal struggle feels to me like what they're exploring here. Because also, Loki did die in the Avengers movies. And this Loki, I think it's worth pointing out, is like offshoot Loki. It's not Loki Prime. Loki Prime died. This is a Loki that saw his chance and, in one of the little time variations, grabbed the Tesseract and, blipped out into another time and place. And so now he's been corralled by this sort of supernatural agency that manages disruptions in time in order to keep everything from collapsing. And so, you know, the long arm of that law is reaching out to grab him.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. We should point out an underline that this Loki is the Loki right after the Battle of New York, right after having lost the Battle of New York, right? In Avengers. That's when he skipped out, which means this is a Loki who has not lost his mother, Freya. This is a Loki who has not built up his relationship with his brother. This is a less evolved Loki. It's kind of a fun thing to do. That's a soft reboot on a character who has, I think the phrase Waldron used was arced out, right? Like, has made his emotional development. Now we get to reboot and go back to like, a less mature Loki, possibly more fun Loki, if that's your flavor of fun. So that's where we are setting up here. Let's go to that agency that grabs Loki. So this world that we're in, that we're launching off of, if you've seen any of the trailers, you will see it, is the TVA. Anthony Breskin, what can you tell me about the TVA?
I mean, we don't really fully know. We know what's been shown in the promotions, but, we have an understanding ourselves that this group is, they're kind of like the FBI, but they're not in our timeline. They're not in any timeline. They're these sort of watchers. They're in their own dimension outside of it. And that they were created as a sort of retroactive way of fixing disruptions in the, I guess you'd call it, the time-space continuum. It's a little bit of a high concept, but, you know, whenever you're dealing with time travel, that's how it goes. What else do you think people should know in advance? Like, I think unpacking it as part of the show is kind of the fun, so I don't want to spoil it too much for people. But what else do you think is necessary?
Sure. A fun thing that if you watch the trailers, there's a lot. It looks like it's both beautiful, like in a sort of 1960s kind of sci-fi way, and tedious bureaucracy at the same time. And I think they've said in other reviews that they were inspired by the DMV to create the TVA, right?
It's very bureaucratic. It's not magical. Yeah. It's a bureaucracy.
A lot of lines and paperwork and stuff like that. But you've got a couple different levels of authority here. We don't have to get too much into it. But I will say that, like, from what I know from the comics, I haven't seen any of Loki yet, right? So I'm not spoiling anything. But, like, from what I know from the comics, a punishment, you know, if the TVA sees a branch of time, something that is too wildly outside the realm of acceptable branching of time. And we learn in Avengers Endgame that, like, the timeline can branch, right? If they see something that's just too chaotic, is going to just screw everything up, they might delete a person or delete a timeline. That's something that they can do. So they can blip you or your entire timeline out of existence, right? So that might be something that they're threatening Loki with, possibly. I don't know.
They're like time gardeners in a way. Like, they can just prune it back.
Yes. I love that. We've got three levels of authority here. We've got, at least, right? We've got judges. And let's go into the casting a little bit, right? So we've got the judges. And Gugu Mbatha-Raw is playing one of the judges named Ravona Renslayer, who we will come back to in sort of the minutiae section. But that is the judges.
That's Harry Potter sounding name, don't you think? She would be in Ravenclaw with the name.
Rowena Ravenclaw, Ravona Renslayer. I got you. We've got Owen Wilson, of course, here. He's an administrator playing Mr. Mobius M. Mobius.
Can we pause on that name now, or do you want to get to that later?
Mobius, again,
these are, how would you describe them? Like mystical beings, supernatural beings in some way?
I think in the comics, a lot of them are clones, to be honest with you, but I don't know what we're dealing with in this version here.
Yeah, but they're not human, per se, right?
Yeah, I would say
They're something else. And Mobius, anybody who's taken a strip of paper, twisted it, and then connected the ends knows that at that point you have a two-dimensional object that only has one, or a three-dimensional object that only has one side, which is weird. Like, you could trace the edge and you just keep going in a loop. So Mobius strip is that little schoolyard craft. And so there's a bit of, like, infinity implied in the name. He's an infinite type being, I guess.
Yeah. And we've seen this, the Mobius concept in the MCU recently, in Endgame, when Tony Stark is trying to crack time travel. He figures it out by using an inverted Mobius strip, is his endgame time travel approach. So there's that. And last but certainly not least, we've got the time monitors, who are sort of like the physical enforcers of this agency. Wunmi Misaku is one of them. She's fantastic. She was so good in Lovecraft Country. She's been in a million things. She got a BAFTA nomination this last year for this film, His House. So I'm so excited she's here.
I love His House.
Yeah.
Please watch that on Netflix if you like a scary movie. She's great.
She's so good. And then the great Sasha Lane is another time monitor. And they just have, their names are like B-15 and C-20. They don't have like fun Harry Potter names. But that's the TVA as far as we know right now. Mm-hmm. Are you ready to get into some other casting? Anthony Rustigan?
Yes, of course. I'm ready to go wherever you want to go in our timeline until we get deleted.
Here comes what's really interesting about Loki. I believe that what we will be watching is Loki hopping into various of these various branching timelines and meeting up with other Loki.
That explains the kid Loki aspect of the comic. And,
so we're pretty sure there's a kid Loki. We're pretty sure there's a lady Loki who's also from the comics.
So lady Loki is another incarnation of this trickster god.
Mm-hmm.
How does he have all these incarnations? We need to explain
it's an Asgardian thing that they sort of like, that's what Ragnarok is. This is a sort of like you die and then like everything reblooms. Yeah. Odin is forever sort of regenerating. It's sort of like Doctor Who, you regenerate. And I think usually,
so this similar
is a mixture
spirits,
of Norse lore and Marvel lore. But yeah, go ahead.
Similar spirits, same memories, or do they start over again?
I mean, let's see. Based on the comic we were reading, the Kid Loki in that comic,
he doesn't have the same memories. He doesn't know what's up. So it's almost like a clone in a way, right? Like you're a clone.
But
it's
the same like spirit, almost?
Same. It's like the same nature versus nurture thing. Like if you take two twins and you separate them and they're raised differently, you know, there are all those stories about how like, well, the separated twins, like they both became firefighters and they both married somebody who looks the same, you know, or they have like all these weird like synchronicities in their lives. So it seems like if you were to create a clone of yourself and then have somebody else raise her, she wouldn't grow up just like you, but she would grow up with the same sort of dispositions as you, right? So that's what we're dealing with, I think.
Right.
At least I'm trying to wrap my mind around.
Possibly. And I think that refraction disposition, right? That refraction of disposition, that refraction of identity across a Kid Loki, a Lady Loki. And I won't talk necessarily about the casting of those characters because those are still question marks. I'll just say there's probably an older Loki, and we do know that Richard E. Grant is in this show. And wouldn't Richard E. Grant be perfect for an older Tom Hiddleston character?
You know what,
right?
it kind of reminds me of is like, you know, when they're casting a role and they're like, I would like this type. You know,
yeah.
It's like, bring me the poor man's Brad Pitt or like bring me under budget Brad Pitt or bring me.
Yeah.
You know, that they're just they're types, right? They're personality types. Or this actor reminds me of this other actor. And you see it like when people start to break out, everybody goes, oh, you're the next dot, right. dot, dot. And I kind of feel like, you know, Richard Grant and Tom Hiddleston, like they're in the same casting file. But just separated by a generation, I guess you'd say.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I love that. I completely agree. Mm. So I love this idea, and this is sort of what Waldron will talk about in this interview, where it's like the idea of this show and to him of television in general, he names Mad Men as one of his favorite shows, right? And so this idea that like Mad Men is about Don Draper, kind of figuring out who he is over the course of Mad Men, that doesn't necessarily mean he's going to change who he is, but that knowing is sort of a satisfying journey for a character. A more sort of genre sci-fi friendly version of this, and this is a Waldron quote, he says, in the case of Marty McFly, where he can encounter a younger version of his parents who are his age, and that helps him understand them better, and then he understands himself better, right? That's Back to the Future, right? So this is like, okay, what if Loki gets to do that, but it's literally himself in different branching realities. And what if one of them's, you know, a kid, one of them's older, and one of them's Lady Loki, and probably one or two of them will be played by Tom Hiddleston himself. You know, we get double Hiddleston. So that, I believe, is, you know, what sends him hopping through the branches we can get into a little later. But like that, I think, is the joy, is the absolute jewel box of a treat that's in store for us. Of course, from a Rick and Morty writer, because it's a classic Rick and Morty. There's like this, there's this episode of Rick and Morty called Council of Ricks, right? Where Rick is tasked by Council of Ricks. Like the only way he can save himself is to go track down a worse version of himself that's hopping through time and space. You know what I mean? That's an episode of Rick and Morty. So like, are we going to get a council of Lokis, essentially? You know what I mean? Like Loki has to find the worst version of himself somewhere in time and stop them. And that's the only a Loki can catch a Loki sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? I think that's what we're going to see. So I'm excited. Anything else you want to talk about sort of like big picture before we get into this interview?
Well, let's see. I think Hiddleston, we should talk about Hiddleston a little bit, what he's brought to this role. Like, it's a character who's gone back and forth in our sympathies. You know, you loathe him, you fear him, you like him. He's so charming. And he occasionally has been helpful, but usually goes back to being trouble. You know, he's not like a Snape type character where he seems bad, but then really deep down, heart of gold. he, deep down, I don't know what Loki is. Definitely not a good person, but he's somebody who's struggling and also feels things, feels pain, is, you know, motivated by his feelings of being an outsider. A really interesting character, and I think Hiddleston brought a lot of dimension to him.
Absolutely.
Don't you think?
There's a lot of complexity to his character, especially like in his relationship with Thor, with Chris Hemsworth's Thor. That brother relationship is one of my favorites in the MCU. And I think this idea of allowing Tom Hiddleston this playground in which to not only play one Loki, but many different flavors of Loki. I mean, yes, please give that to me. I want it. So I think that's also one of the inspirations for the show is Hiddleston's versatility and his complexity, right? That he can play great drama and snarky comedy within a hair's breadth, you know,
while wearing that crazy helmet with the.
How does he pull it off?
I don't know what those tusks are. They look like mammoth tusks or something. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, the Loki horns. All right. Well, let us hear from. I will stop spoiling our own interview with Michael Waldron. Let's hear from Waldron himself on his Loki plans. His doctor. He talks about Doctor Strange. He talks a little bit of Star Wars. Like, we got it all. It's all here. Stylistically.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hi, quick note from Joanna here before we get to the interview with Michael Waldron. I just want to say that this conversation was taped over two different days. So if it seems like I'm circling back to something we already talked about a little bit, like why do you ask about Loki here and then again later? That's because it was a second sort of installment of the conversation. Also, at one point, Michael Waldron's very adorable dog came in. And so if you hear some snuffling, that is the dog, not Waldron or myself. So please do enjoy this conversation with Michael Waldron. I've talked to Kevin Feige before, and something that a lot of people don't realize about him is that he was not a comic book geek growing up, right? He loved movies. He didn't love comics. So I'm curious for you, what did you love growing up that made you want to get into screenwriting?
I loved pro wrestling. That was what I loved. That was like the first serialized storytelling that on TV and that I was drawn to in like the 90s. Everything was so procedural. And I remember as a kid watching like Power Rangers and stuff, and it would drive me crazy. They'd have these big battles and everything. And then the next week, it's like, well, that didn't even happen. And it drove me crazy. But so I think what I loved about wrestling, even as a kid, was there were stakes. If, you know, Hulk Hogan turned bad, 1 week, that had big ramifications for the rest of my life, as far as I was concerned. And so I think that's why I was so drawn to it.
Tell me about your adventures, through the Blacklist.
That that was, so I had, after Community, I created a show about wrestling. I created Heels in 2017, and in 2017, that got picked up by Stars, picked up to a writer's room, which I ran. We wrote the first season, and then we couldn't cast it. And so the show didn't get made. And I was like, well, so much for my meteoric rise. My career's over. I guess this is it for me. I'm like 29, like really languishing. And I was like, you know, I came out here wanting to write Marvel movies and wanting to write Star Wars and that stuff. And I asked my reps, I was like, how do I, you know, I created a TV show about wrestling. How come I'm not on the Marvel list? And they're like, 'cause you haven't written a movie. You need to basically write a feature sample. And so I kind of licked my wounds after Heels went on the shelf and said, all right, let me prove to myself that I can still write. And that was when I wrote Worst Guy of All Time, which I wrote really fast. I just wrote a draft in like 2 weeks and then spent a few months just revising it and everything. And that was, you know, after a year of grinding it out on like a premium cable drama with serious themes and everything, it was fun to just write something with, you know, that was a comedy with a lot of romance. I would be happy just being Nora Ephron is the truth.
Uh-huh.
And so this was my sci-fi attempt at that. And so that, you know, I wrote that script and it was a blast. And I went on to Rick and Morty that year, 2018. I worked on season 4. And then it wound up on the blacklist. And that was an amazing, you know, those guys are so great what they do. It was like really cool just kind of like going through that whole process, meeting all the other different writers. You know, when I went in to pitch on Loki, I think the first thing Kevin Feige said to me was, congratulations on the blacklist. And I was like, oh shit.
Oh no.
Glad I got on that thing. And
so tell me about that first Marvel meeting. How did you get it? How did you get in that room?
I had heard that Marvel was doing a Loki TV show about mm-hmm. time travel. I had just written this stupid little time travel movie, and I knew that was hopefully a good enough sample to get me in the room. And so that, you know, that's what got me that first meeting with Stephen Broussard and Kevin Wright, who are the two primary producers and executives on the project. And I came in and I was honest with them. You know, I think like Kevin Feige, I'm not a massive comics nerd.
Right.
You know, I grew up, again, a pro wrestling guy, probably more of a Star Wars guy.
Uh-huh.
But my love of Marvel came from the movies. I knew even then, before I'd ever worked with him, how good of an actor Tom Hiddleston was. Mm-hmm. Like, and all right, suddenly just the ceiling for the show felt so high to me. Here's this blockbuster movie villain who's known around the world and so beloved, and we're going to get to do 6 episodes with him. Like you're going to get to do what great television does, which is deconstruct that character in a more intimate, quiet, occasionally digressive way. It's like my favorite shows, Mad Men, The Leftovers, stuff like that. Like getting to do that with Loki.
Yeah.
I just said to them, I was like, guys, I think this should be the best show ever made. That was my pitch, was like, you know, what if the Loki show was simply the best show anybody's ever seen?
Not a bad pitch. Yeah. I'm curious. You know, I've actually talked to some other people who pitched on Loki, and I talked to Jack about her process. And I know that for WandaVision. And so I know that going in, you go in and you get a basic structure of what they want the show to be. They already have an idea of what they want the show to be, and then you've got to hang some meat on those bones. So what can you say about sort of the meat that you put on the bones of the idea that they had?
Yeah, I mean, they had the world. That was the big, which, you know, to their credit, was such a brilliant creative choice on their own that came from Kevin Feige, Kevin Wright, Stephen Broussard, to put Loki in the world of the TVA. And so that was the sandbox that we had to play on. And I think what I came up with was the emotional engine of the whole thing. You know, this is a character there's been 10 years of movies with this guy. Like, he's lived and died many times. In fact, how do we make sure we're not just doing the same thing we've seen before? How do we break new ground with this character? And so it was just figuring out that emotional core. What was I going to rip off in each episode? That was what great, better movies and TV shows did I intend to rip off?
Can you tell us some of those better movies and TV shows you ripped off?
Oh, man. I mean, so many. Blade Runner, for sure. Mad Men. Before Sunrise. All sorts of inspirations. Catch Me If You Can. Another big one.
Let me ask the really nerdy question then, which is, I know you're not a comics guy necessarily, but obviously if you're going to write the Loki show, you have to read the Loki comics. So if you could recommend one Loki comic for folks to read to get, you know, prepared for the show, what would you say?
The Kid Loki comic. It was one that I was really drawn to that I just thought was very cool. It's The Journey into Mystery, but it's Loki dies and is reborn as a child. And it's his journey, and it's inspirational, not necessarily because our show is about a child version of Loki, but because it investigates and excavates his humanity in a more vulnerable, you know, a way that you only can with a child. A child version of Loki is still so burdened by the sins of his past self and everything, which is very much, I think, what our version of Loki is running up against in the TVA. You know, he's just, look, this is who you are. This is who you've always been. A villain. Can a tiger change its stripes?
I want to ask you a process question, which is, you know, having, even though Heels didn't go, having, you know, gone through the process of running a show, there's a difference between your standard showrunner and the Marvel head writer position. Those are two different things. And I was wondering if you could sort of delineate what those differences are.
Yeah. I mean, I think the simple thing is that a regular showrunner, like on Heels, you start out, you run the writer's room, and then as things proceed in production, you kind of stay the chief decision maker, on set, through, you basically fulfill the role that a director does in a feature, where you're the final say on set, in post, in everything. Right. It's you're the author of that thing. In the Marvel side, it works differently, but I think has worked really well, at least in our case, where I came in, I was the creator and the head writer, and me and our writing staff, you know, we were the first department on, is how I like to think of it. and we got to start running the race, and it's lay the foundation for my vision of what that story would be in conjunction with what, you know, Marvel wanted. And then Kate Herron came on board as our director, and that was amazing because Kate's a great creator and artist and filmmaker herself. And so suddenly we had the benefit of fresh eyes on this whole thing. And so then, you know, in the process of revising and everything, we had all of her input as we hurtled into production and all of that. You know, I would say that it's been run more like a feature in that, you know, it's a probably more director driven. I mean, just by, I'm not the showrunner in the sense that I'm not the one with the budget hanging over my head.
Let's say something like, if there needs to be a rewrite, of something for whatever reason, what's the process behind that? Have you handed things over completely at that point, or?
No, that's still me or in our case. I wasn't on set because I moved over to Doctor Strange as I was getting ready to go to Atlanta for Loki. Kevin called me and said, "Hey, there's something else." And that was just, we were fortunate as we'd worked really hard and we'd gotten Loki into a really good place. And so my number two, Eric Martin, was the writer who was on set there.
Okay.
And he, you know, it was a collaboration between him and me. If there was stuff getting rewritten on the day, that was usually him, you know, his fingerprints are all over the thing as well. And he did amazing work. I got to be the author of the whole thing. Kate got to go make it. And, you know, it's worked really, really well. It's also, frankly, there's some freedom in it because, you know, show running, seeing something all the way through is an all encompassing job. I have had the benefit of, I was able to go do Doctor Strange.
Let's talk about that Doctor Strange call that you got and what that was like and what you were tasked, you know, obviously like Strange had already been worked on by other writers, et cetera. So what was that process of bringing you on?
That was, I was leaving Owen Wilson's house, which is already
like
surreal.
You do, right?
because we'd met, because he was getting ready to go to Atlanta. So was I. And so already I'm like, oh my God, it's Owen Wilson. and Kevin called me and, you know, let me know that they were going in a different direction on Doctor Strange. And they wanted to bring me on, and I was thrilled. Like, I loved working on Loki. I knew I wanted to stay in the family. I felt like Loki was in a great place. And I even then was kind of like, you know, I was eager for maybe what the next challenge would be. I like starting in on something new.
Yeah.
And so at the time, I think that was February of last year, 2020. The movie was going to go into production in May. I came on, and then Sam Raimi came on board about a week later. So suddenly I'm working with a hero of mine.
Right.
Literally, you know, one of the reasons I'm probably a writer is his movies. And it was basically, you know, it's kind of like, all right, at first, how do we just make a movie in 2 months? But COVID quickly descended upon us.
Right.
The one thing that afforded was the opportunity to just start from scratch on Doctor Strange. And Sam and I were able to kind of dig in and just, you know, start over on something that we were both really excited about. And kind of make it our own. The work that Scott had done establishing that world certainly is all over the place and is already there. But just Sam and I had time, and I was like, all right, well, we're not shooting now until November. What do we want this movie to be?
Right.
And so that, you know, I got to spend my 2020 on Zooms with Sam Raimi.
Not bad.
Yeah, not too bad. And so then, you know, we figured that out, and I wrote that movie, and then that's what I went over. I was there all of last November, came back for the holidays, and then was in London January until April 18th, shooting Doctor Strange.
Here's a question I think that is interesting for you to be on the ground floor of, which is this idea of the changing relationship between the Marvel TV and the Marvel film. Because, you know, Kevin gave that interview recently where he was like, oh yeah, Strange was supposed to show up at the end of WandaVision, and we decided that that was not the direction that we wanted to go in. But when something like that happens, how does it ripple over into your film, a decision like that on the TV side?
This was Kevin's attitude from our very earliest conversations on Loki, was these TV shows are going to be just as vital to the ongoing story of the MCU as the movies, and just as consequential and everything. So but at the same time, characters that were going to cameo in one movie end up not cameoing all the time.
Sure.
Like, so it's like, it was more just like, okay, Doctor Strange didn't show up in the tag of that. You know, it wasn't the fact that that WandaVision was TV, for him not showing up in a TV show versus him not showing up in a movie, didn't really affect things one way or another. It was more just like, yeah, you roll with the punches. The story is always sort of shifting. We knew, I had the benefit of, I got to be pretty good friends with Jack Schaefer, because she is the best. And her and I went out to dinner early on in the process. I think their writer's room was like 4 weeks ahead of us. And we just became great pals. And I really admired her so much and all the work she was doing. And so when I got brought on to Doctor Strange, you know, I really, especially because Wanda's part of that story, I just wanted to make sure I wasn't going to let my friend down. Because I, you know,
and she, like, teed it up for you, and you're like, no, let me.
I was like, I can't shit the bed. She did such a great job.
Right.
I can't come in and blow this thing. So we had a lot of conversations. These things are always changing. And so whether or not one character shows up at the end of something or not, I think our minds as the writers, we know to never hang anything on just that thing happening, because for all you know, it might change.
Yeah. Oh, I'm interested about this sort of like growing, I don't know if you want to call it like community of Marvel writers that hasn't really been the case in previously in the MCU, but like your friendship with Jack, I know that your friend Jeff's working on Ant-Man, you know, stuff like that. So is there sort of like this feeling that there's this growing little class of Marvel writers that are able to talk to each other, bounce ideas off each other, that sort of thing?
It's certainly great, because we are working in a shared universe. Again, the charge is always make your thing the best thing.
Yeah.
And then figure it out. But Jeff Loveness, who's writing the new Ant-Man, is one of my closest friends, because we worked together on Rick and Morty and just became great pals.
Right.
And so he's dealing with the quantum realm, and I clearly was dealing with time travel and the multiverse. So of course, our conversations are probably illegal to have digitally. We have to meet on a bridge somewhere,
right? Trench coats at midnight.
Yeah, exactly. And it's great. And like and Bisha Ali, who was one of my writers on Loki, was the creator of Miss Marvel. And like I said, having Eric on Loki being there on set, and Jack, and just having all those friendships, I think to the extent that it can feel like a family, it helps us all, because it's just, you know, it's easy for me to text and say, hey, what are you doing with so-and-so? I'm thinking about this.
Yeah.
We can make sure we're not messing things up too bad for one another. Although part of that is the fun is, you know, creating a disaster and just saying, yeah, we'll leave that for the next writers. but then you do that on Loki and you find yourself writing Doctor Strange. and you have to clean up your own mess.
Oh, another nice mess I've gotten myself into. Can you tell me about Doctor Strange?
I mean, I can tell you that it's a ride. It is a thrilling, very Sam Raimi. I mean, Sam is an absolute genius. I think the movie is incredibly visually thrilling. Between Sam and everything that he does, John Matheson, our DP who shot Gladiator and Logan, like, I just think the look of it is going to be unlike anything you've seen in the MCU before. And I think it's, you know, Benedict is amazing as that character. And I really tried, you know, I really loved writing. I mean, you know, he's Indiana Jones to me. You know,
he's Indiana Jones to you. That's interesting.
In a cape, or in a cloak. Doctor Strange would not be happy. What I love about Doctor Strange is he's a hero who can take a punch. Those are, you know, that's what made those Harrison Ford heroes so great. Han Solo and Indy, John McClane. Those guys get their asses kicked. Look at Stephen Strange in the first movie. He's really, you know, he's getting beat up, but he's very capable and everything. Yeah. And I think that's what's great about Benedict. He's such a good actor. I've been so lucky to get to work with Tom, then to get to work with Benedict. Yeah. And then also Lizzie Olsen, I mean, is like, you know, I don't know if there's anyone better working today. Getting to continue Wanda's story was amazing. And so, yeah, look, it's scary. It's fun. It's thrilling. It's a great ride.
What, if anything, can you tell me about Star Wars?
Oh, the Star Wars. You know, it's a thing. It's a real thing. I'm excited. It's still very, very early days. Like I said, I've been just focused on Doctor Strange. I'm excited to keep working with Kevin. I'm also really excited to work with Lucasfilm. You've heard all my references here. Star Wars, Indiana Jones, like Kathy Kennedy. She's made so many of my favorite movies. So to get to collaborate with both of those entities is a dream come true. And I'm excited to see what that becomes.
I want to go back to Loki and ask you something that's been interesting hearing Jack talk about WandaVision and Malcolm talk about Falcon Winter Soldier. Is with Falcon Winter Soldier, they kept pushing this line about it's a 6-hour movie. And Jack's like, I'm definitely making television. So between those two sort of binaries, where would you plop Loki?
It's something, I guess I'd say it's something totally new. It's MCU. It's MCU done hour by hour, weekly, episodically. I never wanted it to feel like it was necessarily just one big movie, because that's, I think, sometimes when episodes themselves just feel like chapters, then it's like they don't necessarily stand alone. And
yeah,
it was really important to me that every episode stood alone as its own thing. And that if you sat down and maybe just watched one episode of the Loki series, you could still get swept up and really enjoy it. So it's certainly, you know, so yeah, I don't know. It felt like we were, again, I go back to something like The Leftovers or like Watchmen, which I admired so much, but it's like every one of those episodes felt like such a distinct short story as opposed to a chapter. And that's a philosophy that I've tried to execute
Do you feel like there are going to be the episodes where you can sort of, where someone can describe it and say, the this episode, the Mad Men episode, or the whatever episode sort of thing?
I hope so. I hope so. If anything, that was kind of how I pitched it. I went in and I had a pretty clear vision for each episode. It was inspirations and everything, because I did want every episode to, like I said, stand alone and feel different from the last. I want the audience to have a different experience every week.
Yeah.
Probably something I carried from Rick and Morty,
right?
You know, which can run a little bit procedural. Not that this is procedural at all, but it's like, I wanted to accelerate things to the point where each week it felt like, oh shit, wait, now we're doing something. Now we're doing that. Now we're doing this. And so that was fun.
It's so easy to describe a Rick and Morty episode, right? To someone, you can just drop one word and they're like, they know exactly which episode you're talking about.
Exactly. And I think that's the sign of a great episode of TV, when it's like, oh, it's that one. It's that episode of Loki. So I hope you can identify our episodes by that or by their respective GIFs, GIFs, whatever.
Oh, you're ready for the memes.
That's what I told Kevin in my pitch. I said, I you know what? I'm going to give you a lot of iconic GIFs.
Oh, I mean,
so,
what more could the show ask for?
That's what the fans want.
If Baby Yoda has taught us anything, it's that GIFs can definitely sell a television show. All right. So you mentioned two Damon Lindelof shows back to back. Is Damon a big influence for you?
Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly a huge fan of his. I mean, Lost, I watched Lost in college. That was like, you know, what a phenomenon that was. The Constant is maybe the best episode of television ever. But I think The Leftovers is, you know, Mad Men's my favorite show. I think The Leftovers is just behind it. I think The Leftovers is astounding. And I loved especially the episodes that tended to digress, that would, you know, follow Matt on the boat on the ferry or something, or Nora at the conference. Yeah, I admire The Leftovers so much. I love that show.
Dan Harmon must also be a big influence for you. Can you talk about like what you learned from Dan?
Dan's great. I mean, Dan, you know, you're lucky when somebody that you just admire as a writer, as a mentor becomes a dear friend. Dan is just first and foremost like a great dude, you know, and just like the kind of guy who will let the writer's PA sit in the room and pitch jokes and ideas and not look down on you, not make you feel stupid, but embrace that and help, you know, and it's like, you know, he ran such a democratic room when I worked with him in the sense that just always the best idea won. I mean, Dan is a notorious perfectionist, you know, and it's so it can always be better to him. That is, I would say he's probably rarely satisfied. So am I. I'm always the least happy with everything I'm doing. But to me, that means that we're doing it right.
Yeah.
There was something that I heard from Bob Murawski, who's the editor on Doctor Strange too, that he learned from Orson Welles, which is you must be the enemy of the film. And that's, I feel like Harmon does a great job of that in a way of just like the enemy of the script, in the sense that like, can this scene be better? Can this joke be better? Can this emotional execution be stronger too? And then just practically, he's just great at accelerated storytelling. You know, I mean, it's beyond just the pure story structure that he's known for, with the story circle and the hero's journey and all that. It's just, you know, look at Rick and Morty. We blow through four sci-fi concepts in an episode that frankly, I'd be sitting going, shit, why did I pitch that? I should have just written a spec based on that. I had this one sci-fi idea that I could have probably went and sold. And now it's just the first quadrant of this episode. And Rick right. ends up making fun of it within 7 minutes. and it's like, but it's, that's the confidence that it's like, well, you're going to come up with a better idea on the heels of that. And yeah. so, you know, that's what I learned from Dan.
Do you feel like Loki runs at a similar pace? I mean, the Rick and Morty pace is breakneck, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, there was an initial, at first in the writers, I was carrying in the Rick and Morty sensibility, and I had to, like, recalibrate and be like, okay, wait, I'm not writing a 22-minute cartoon.
Right, right.
That is insane. and so we, is so no, so not, you can't. You can't. You have to slow down. And when I say accelerated, I don't mean that you're blowing through scenes quickly. Mm-hmm. Loki, in fact, I looked at, you know, I was watching Tarantino movies and Glorious Bastards and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Movies that tend to really luxuriate in these long scenes of dialogue and tension building.
Yeah.
When I think the acceleration is just like, the way the story is hopefully propulsive from one episode to another and just how much ground we're able to cover in Loki's journey.
Something that was really fun talking to Malcolm and Jack was them physically describing sort of some of the stuff in their writer's room. And obviously, like, I don't want you to give away any spoilers, but, you know, Malcolm told me that they printed out Killmonger's speech from Black Panther and posted that up in their writer's room. So is there anything sort of spoiler free that you can say to describe?
I can show you what was all over our writer's room.
Okay.
And it was drawings like this of timelines.
Time branches.
And it was somebody draws one and then a writer comes up and says, no, it's not that, it's this. There was so much because, like I said, we had to create time travel is what it felt like. We had to create an institutional knowledge of how time travel would work within the Time Variance Authority.
Yeah.
And that was just the baseline. And then from there, it was, okay, how can we now tell a story so the audience never has to think about this? So the audience gets it and then never thinks about it again. And so it was a lot of drawings of squiggly timelines.
And I mean, yeah, Endgame does its best to try to present rules of time travel in a way that is digestible for an audience and will ask them to not ask too many questions later on. But like, then of course the audience is asking questions like, what happens when Steve goes back on his own timeline, or what happens, you know, this sort of thing. And is any of this not, I wouldn't say like cleaning up the mess, but hoping to like further refine and define that idea of time travel that's introduced in Endgame?
Yeah. I mean, look, those guys laid the foundation, which I was glad for. It was mm-hmm. like, okay, here's some base rules of what they're able to do. How does time work in the way that the Avengers understand it, at least. But like you said, they had the luxury of it's a 3-hour movie.
Right.
At the end of it, you get to walk out. And it's like, you're going to talk about the time travel and everything, but it's not going to sit with you and probably ruin your experience of the movie. I was always very acutely aware of the fact that there's a week between each of our episodes. And these fans are going to do exactly what I would do, mm-hmm. which is pick this shit apart if it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my charge to our writers, and they more than rose to the task, was to create a time travel logic that hopefully was so airtight that it could sustain over 6 hours. That was the thing. A time travel show is harder than a movie, because in a movie, you can just say, well, who cares? It's time travel. I know it's kind of bullshit. We had to make sure that a lot of this stuff lined up, and that was hard, but it was fun. And there's some time travel sci-fi concepts within there that I was like, I'm eager for my Rick and Morty colleagues to see, to be like, hey, look at what we came up with.
Yeah. I know Kevin is a huge fan of, I think the legend is that he missed his prom because he was in line for Back to the Future 2 or something like that. He's a big, you know, Back to the Future fan. Did you talk at all? Like, what did you talk about in terms of what is the narrative advantage of a time travel story? What do you get out for your characters narratively? I mean, it's fun. It's fun as hell, but like, you know, yeah. Emotionally.
I mean, I think we talked about it as a chance to, you know, you can literally hold up a mirror to your characters in many different ways. You know, perhaps they can encounter other versions of themselves at different points in their lives. In the case of Marty McFly, he can encounter younger version, you know, versions of his parents who are his age, who helps him understand yeah. them better. And then he understands himself better. So I think it was, you know, a character as complex as I think everybody would agree. This is a complex character mm-hmm. that what he's got going on is, you know, is pretty intense up there. And he's always dealing with a lot. And so it was a show that was always going to require some real self-reflection, because isn't that to me, that's what great television is. Like a great movie is about going through a transformative experience that mm-hmm. that fundamentally maybe changes the way you act, the way you behave.
Yeah.
The best TV to me, like Mad Men, is about characters becoming aware of who they are and maybe why they are the way they are. I wouldn't say that Don Draper necessarily changes too much. I mean, maybe after he made that Coke commercial, he wasn't miserable anymore. But
yeah, maybe Esalon changed him. Yoga on the side changed
right,
him. Maybe.
Right. But I think he gained an awareness of who yeah. he was, of how he was broken, of why. And I think that's an interesting thing that television does, and it's holding up that mirror. And so time travel, you know, for a million different reasons, gives you a lot of cool science fiction-y ways to do that.
And I don't expect you to get into the specifics of this, but fans of the Loki comics know that there is a kid Loki, there is a lady Loki, there is a sort of thing. So this idea of meeting yourself along your travels could be literalized in a Loki story.
It certainly could.
It could be. Okay.
it could be. And, you know, it's like, what being is more chaotic than Loki? What do you, you know, what do you have to learn from any version of yourself? Is there anything to learn or, you know, those are all the interesting questions to ask with a character like this.
Let me hop over to Strange for a little bit, if that's okay. I think you compared him to Indiana Jones the last time we talked. But it's interesting. I was talking to some of the people who wrote the first film, and something that they said their issue with or their challenge with Strange that they felt was that he was the Tony Stark that we've known in the MCU is kind of cribbed from Doctor Strange's character in the comics, that they kind of put a lot of Strange in their Tony Stark. So then what are you going to do? Just have another Tony Stark? And their answer seemed to be kind of yes. And we see that a bit in Infinity War when Strange and Tony are sparking off each other. And that version of Strange, I like the first movie. I really love Strange in Infinity War. I think that's an even better opportunity for Benedict to do what he does. How do you think of the way in which the MCU is figuring out how to use Stephen Strange?
I always thought of, I mean, yeah, certainly there's the, I mean, it, yeah, that conflict comes to, you know, he and Tony feel like different sides of the same coin in Infinity War in a really cool way. Narcissistic, sarcastic, clever heroes who, you know, still are able to save the day with a grin. When I first started writing Strange, I think I told you, with Loki, I was like, what's like a touchstone for this character? And I landed on Steve Jobs. So I'm fascinated by Steve Jobs.
All right.
They're both adopted. They're both, you know, and I'm just like, not that Steve Jobs is a villain, but he was a guy who sought control
in
his life in the way that I thought Loki did. And with Doctor Strange, I actually gravitated toward Anthony Bourdain, weirdly. I listened to Kitchen Confidential just to like get in that voice, because it's the thing about Tony, Anthony Bourdain, he's very educated, very sophisticated in the way Steven is. It's like Tony was very much, Tony Stark was very much like man of the people, you know, like, hey, I'm just one of the guys. Like Strange is an elitist.
Yeah.
Like as a neurosurgeon, and even as a sorcerer. And so, and it's like, you know, Anthony Bourdain is a man of the people, but there is that, like, there's just that intense intellect with him. And you always feel like he could eviscerate anybody with his words at any time. But yet, and this is something my assistant Alana pointed out, that Anthony Bourdain never really punches down.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, that was a interesting thing. And so it's like that was maybe the first ingredient in the stew for Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
And then it's like, you know, he's an adventurer. That's probably where the, you know, the Indiana Jones stuff comes from. Why do you have to be the best surgeon? Why do you have to be the best sorcerer? Why do you have to go halfway around the world chasing, you know, ghosts? Like, what are you looking for?
Yeah.
And that stuff's interesting to me. And I think that stuff's interesting to Benedict. And so yeah, he's just a cool hero. I loved writing him.
Given that Steven is a person who can open up a portal and step into another country in a second, or you know, another multiverse, if that's what, you know, your story is about. Then you're thinking about world travelers, right? You're thinking about who's someone who's curious enough to hop around the globe like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, and that's back to the Anthony Bourdain thing. Been everywhere, seen everything. You know, like what surprises you at this point? That's an interesting thing, I think, for all of the heroes in the MCU in a post-Endgame world. Mm-hmm. Like, think about what they've encountered and what they fought. How do you rally yourself to fight the standalone movie villains after you fought Thanos?
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing.
And I mean, that's the, you know, looking at something like, the post-Endgame MCU has been so interesting in that so much of it seems to be about mourning something, right? You know, Wanda's about mourning Vision. Falcon Winter Soldier is in its own way about mourning Steve, or, you know, not that he's dead, but the lack of him there. Loki, I don't know. I was thinking about that as a consistent theme, and I was wondering if Loki is maybe about, because the Loki that we meet is going to be the Loki who, you know, hopped a ride out of the Avengers film, and not the Loki we've seen go through all this emotional development. And I don't know if he's going to learn about all the emotional development that he went through, but I mean, that has to be a wild experience to know that there is a version of you that has lived something so different. And are you mourning something in yourself? I don't know if I just talked myself into a circle, but
no, of course. Those were all fascinating questions that I like asked myself. And I think there's a bigger question, is does he know that?
Right.
Does it, you know, is he, that was a choice to make, is he aware of all that? You know, I think from a, from a practical standpoint, the fans of this character know that and watched him experience a character arc through Infinity War. And in a lot of ways, maybe even arc out, you know, it felt like he was tiptoeing right to the edge of a reconciliation with Thor and everything. And it's like what you might call a redemption arc. I think it was our responsibility to do something different, you know, to do justice to the character that they'd fallen in love with since Thor the Dark World. You know, that and make sure that Loki is everybody enjoys him and is still there, but it's ultimately it's a different version of the character who hasn't undergone that growth yet. We had to embrace that, and to me that was always an opportunity to do something different. That's why our show exists.
I was talking to someone much smarter than me who was just talking about how they felt like every story should be a love story, that WandaVision is so compelling because it's a love story, and that this is at the beginning of Falcon the Winter Soldier. He was saying Falcon the Winter Soldier should be a love story about Sam and Bucky, doesn't have to be romance. It can just be, you know, this is about these two characters coming together, you know?
I think that's great. James Ponsell, who's one of my friends and collaborators, he said that before, and it struck with me that every story is a love story, or something like that. And it's true. And that can be a story between a father and a son.
Right.
Good Will Hunting is a love story between Matt Damon and Robin Williams' character. Yeah. So I'm always looking for that.
Can I ask you about winning an Emmy and what that was like for you?
Please. It's not in here. I can go get it. I want to look at it.
Yeah. No.
All, so much of the credit for that episode goes to Jeff Loveness, Al Rolundi, the writers. I was, of all the episodes of the season, I didn't have a ton to do with that one. I was off on Loki, but happy to ride their coattails. I love to have the Emmy. It's fun to do bits with. I like to bring it to my friends' houses and just remind them that I have one.
You have one? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy to have it.
Yeah, they're not already impressed. You're writing a Star Wars or whatever, but you're like,
my mind immediately went to the EGOT. I was like, all right, Oscar, yeah. I figure I could figure that out.
Sure.
Right? Tony, write a play, write a music, you know. Mm-hmm. Right? So suddenly that's where your mind goes. And then I was like, all right, who's the youngest EGOT winner? So
what's your Grammy plan?
That one's gonna be tough. That I'm like maybe an audiobook. Maybe that's the I don't know how scrupulous of a way to win a Grammy that is, but I write a musical that gets adapted into a movie and somehow win a Grammy.
Absolutely, one shot. Tony, Grammy, Oscar. Yeah.
For all you know, Doctor Strange is a musical. That could be the one.
I would love that. I would absolutely love a musical Doctor Strange. I think my last question for you might just be in the casting of Loki.
That was, you know, I think Mobius was always the we knew so much was going to ride on casting that character, because, you know, it's he serves as kind of the face of the TVA in a way, and as you can see from the trailers, somebody that was going to have a lot of interaction with Tom, and need to, his energy was going to have to complement Loki's energy in a compelling way. They had a relationship, obviously, from Midnight Paris. They'd worked together on that a little bit, and they
That's
just
right.
you know, they instantly clicked creatively. And so, you know, that I would say, you know, Mobius and Loki, that's one of the love stories that you might see in Loki for sure. Although if you print that, the fans are going to, like,
no, I won't put it that way. Don't worry.
but knowing our fans, but
in that context, I know what you mean. I mean, you referenced Catch Me If You Can before, and I would consider Catch Me If You Can a love story between Tom Hanks's character and Leonardo DiCaprio's character.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
That makes sense. All right. Well, I think we did it.
We did it. I'm so glad we met again. Thanks for having me. I'm glad I was interesting enough that you wanted to talk to me again.
All right. So this is the back section of the podcast where Anthony and I get to play a little nerdier, a little more detail oriented. I want to start with something that Waldron said about this idea that, like, he wanted, you know, I was asking him, WandaVision is definitely a TV show, right? They, like, you can talk about singular episodes of WandaVision, like, you know, the Dick Van Dyke Show episode or the Bewitched episode or whatever. That's how WandaVision rolled out. And then with Falcon and the Winter Soldier, they were saying, like, oh, this is a 6-hour movie. We're making a 6-hour movie. I really could not pluck out a single episode of Falcon and the Winter Soldier, like the one where Zemo shows up, I guess. I don't know. You know, it's a little muddier, right? So I asked Waldron, like, are you making a film here? Are you making a TV show? And he's like, definitely a TV show. This is definitely a show where it's like the one where Loki X. And I was just wondering, like, what you think about that, about, like, Marvel approaching their Disney Plus opportunity as, like, a TV versus film, long-form film.
I do think you have to consider that. You're telling a story in chapters, and people may binge it, but the way a story feels when it's stretched out over numerous sections can be different. You know, you need to have some beats there and some satisfaction and resolution each time, in addition to the generation of new drama and new tension and new things that keep you coming back the next time. So it's a different form. You know, in some ways you could think of what's it called, the infinity cycle, that
saga.
I thought he called it a cycle.
Maybe the
infinity saga, but it is kind of a cycle, right, where you've got the three phases that all comprise one big overarching story. So you could see them each as like 2-2.5 hour episodes of TV, each of them building up to it. I think, like, what makes them distinct, like what makes these segments distinct, will be interesting. And I'm not sure. Obviously, neither of us have seen those episodes yet. But WandaVision, you know, had the means of saying, this is the 60s episode, this is the 70s episode, this is the 80s episode, this is the flashback episode, this is the very special episode. It had a little cadence to it. So I'm curious what that cadence will be.
I mean, possibly one thing could be like the one with Kid Loki, the one with Richard E. Grant Loki, the one with, Loki for President Loki from the trailer. You know what I mean? Like D.B. Cooper Loki, like all this sort of stuff. So like that was sort of my thought, was that maybe it'll be flavored by the other Lokis that he encounters.
Yeah.
And, you know, that will be that. We'll get to Liddy Loki in a second. And that maybe even the font, you know, I was thinking about, you know how the font of the logo is like four different fonts, and then it sort of ratchets through as, you know, if you watch one of the trailers, it'll like ratchet through the different fonts on the different letters. And I was thinking, like, what if each episode like you see the Loki logo and it will like look, it'll be all unified, one Loki. That's just a guess, but like this is the one where all the Loki letters are green or are all made of wood or are all gold or like whatever it is. I don't know. Just a thought. All right. So let's run through some of the inspirations that Waldron mentioned. Some surprising fun inspirations here. Catch Me If You Can. The great Leonardo DiCaprio, Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg film. Well, one of my favorite films, actually, which is about a con man as played by DiCaprio, chased
a charming, scofflaw.
Chased around the world by, a cop in the form of Tom Hanks. I could see Loki and Mobius sort of slotting into this? What do you think? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I could see that. That's a good comp. Like, you know, what's interesting is, again, the character Frank W. Abagnale from Catch Me If You Can. We liked him, and we were kind of rooting for him in the same way that we do with Loki. Like, he's bad, but it's fun. It's fun to break the rules. And even though you know you shouldn't, he shouldn't, or that he's doing wrong, it's like kind of there's just an appeal there.
Yeah,
you're rooting for DiCaprio, not for the Tom Hanks FBI agent.
He's you're kind of rooting for them both, I think, in that movie, and I think that's what makes that movie so beautiful. Is like one of the best parts of that movie is like the Christmas phone call that they have, where it's this just sort of like beautiful moment between these two characters, where like Tom Hanks's character is almost rooting for Leo as well. You know what I mean? Like
a little bit. It's like a father-son relationship.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like,
exactly.
You know, DiCaprio didn't have that. His father taught him to be a scammer. And, you know, Tom Hanks is like the steady force, the steadiness that grounds you. And so maybe that's what we're going to get here. But I kind of don't see that because I don't think that that's the relationship these guys would have struck up. It seems a little more like almost like overbearing big brother and troublemaking younger brother. like you know, Cain and Abel type situation. One guy goes good, the other goes bad. And the tension between
with the Mobius character.
Yeah. What do you think?
Maybe. Yeah. To me, he just looks like sort of a wry, which Owen Wilson character isn't wry, but like a wry kind of fatigued bureaucrat. Who thinks that Loki might be able to help him. But I don't think of it as like a big... I mean, if you say Cain and Abel, I would think Thor and Loki. You know what I mean? It's a different sort of relationship.
Yeah, but Thor, Thor just doesn't have much interest in Loki unless he's bad. You know what I mean? When Loki's behaving, Thor doesn't pay attention to him. This is like this sibling relationship where it's like, come on, you can do this. Clean up your apartment and pay your rent and like... You know, get the boot off of your car that's parked illegally on the street. And like, come on, you can walk the straight and narrow. Like, I need your help. And, you know, I don't know, maybe like a Mycroft Holmes and Sherlock situation. Like, you know, get yourself together. Yes, you have all these powers. But like, you know, I'm the steady one. You know, the straight man. Abbott to his Costello, let's say. Throwing out a lot of disparate.
You're just throwing out really fresh new comparisons like Abbott and Costello. No, I love it. All right, let's talk about Blade Runner as an inspiration here. I'm having trouble laying Blade Runner over this. What do you think? Maybe it's because it's like replicant hunting a replicant sort of thing.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Keeping things in order, but then do you really want like the thing I'm presuming here is that, you know, Decker in Blade Runner, like, I don't know, he starts to realize, like, I'm destroying these replicants, but they do feel things. Like, they are human in some way. So am I the bad guy, you know? And I think if the point of the show is to catch and kill these offshoots of Loki, you know, maybe at some point he's going to be like, well, you know, why can't we just let them be? You know, that was the tension in Blade Runner. Maybe we could just let this happen. And we don't have to tie it off, you know?
I like it. I can see a Tears in the Rain sort of moment could possibly be coming here. He mentioned Tarantino films and Glorious Bastards specifically. And in that reference, he was talking about, because I was asking him, I was like, okay, are we going to get like zany Rick and Morty, like hopping through time, hopping through worlds, sometimes, you know, many in the span of one episode? And he was like, no. He was like, we're gonna get some Rick and Morty-esque stuff, but what we're getting is and tell me if you think I'm excited about this, Anthony. He wants us to luxuriate in long scenes of dialogue and tension building.
That sounds like the Joanna recipe for what makes a good Marvel movie or series.
Catnip to me. I'm excited. So yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking about like the tavern scene in Glorious Bastards, one of the greatest film scenes of all time, you know, with Fassbender and et cetera. Mad Men, which we've already talked about a little bit. We'll get to D.B. Cooper in a second, but that's a Mad Men adjacent thing. But I think just that journey of Don Draper is something that he's kind of interested in. He mentioned The Leftovers. He mentioned did you watch The Leftovers, Anthony?
I have not. I've read the book, though.
Okay, great book.
I know they diverge.
Yeah. Season 3 of The Leftovers has this wild episode, which I think it's called It's a Matt World, where... a character played by Christopher Eccleston, Matt, goes on a boat ride and there's this like lion sex cult on the boat. It's a wild episode of television. Brilliant. And he was like, that's the flavor I'm going for. The lion sex cult episode of Leftovers. So if you're a Leftovers fan, get excited about that. And then lastly, and this is sort of going to lead me into my next thing, but he said Before Sunrise. What does Before Sunrise mean to you, Anthony Breskin?
They meet cute. And it's just like about having this day of infatuation and it's going to end. You're going to sundown and that's going to be it. And, you know, obviously it goes on a little further than that, but in the first one, it doesn't part way. So I think it's about the temporariness of things and knowing they're not going to last and enjoying them while they do. That's what Before Sunrise meant to me.
And it's such a talky film. It's just the two of them talking. Walking and talking the whole film, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that brings me to my next point, which is back to Lady Loki, who I think is the female lead of the show. They're hiding her in the trailers, but I'm pretty sure Lady Loki is, and I think she's the antagonist as well. I think she's the most evil, chaotic Loki, and that he is being sent. I have not seen an episode, so I don't know. But just based on what Waldron was saying, I'm like, okay, what if? Let's play a what if game. What if Lady Loki is the antagonist of the show, the chief mischief maker? And the TVA is like, track her down, kill her, stop her. We need you, Loki, to do that. But who is Loki most likely to fall in love with if not himself, right?
Well, it's if we're going to go back to myths, it's not a Norse myth, but Narcissus. And, you know, staring into your own reflection, and the fact that she's the worst of the worst also would be, talk about catnip for Loki. Like, I could see him definitely being enchanted by that. Ooh, she's even meaner and more crazy than I am.
Yeah, he's gonna admire her, I think. So my question is, you know, like, I was trying to figure out, like, what could be sort of the stake? Like, what could the TVA do to convince Loki to work for them? Like, one thing is like, your survival depends on it. That's one option, right? Another option is like, there's scenes in the trailer of Mobius sort of showing Loki his life. And it's not just his life before he stepped out of Avengers, because there's some Ragnarok stuff in there too. So like, his mother's death hasn't happened in his version of time yet. And that is one of the like big, big wounds for Loki, is Freya's death in Thor: The Dark World. So I'm wondering if, you know, if he's working a second agenda, if he's trying to figure out how to save his mom, like, you know, that's all that's just stuff that I think is integral to Loki that I think might be interesting in the show. But whoever's hunting, whatever he's doing, I can only imagine that whatever he tells the TVA that he's doing, he probably has another agenda running because he's Loki, right? That would be my guess. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Look out for the hidden Loki agenda at all times.
You know, have you ever seen the Albert Brooks movie with Meryl Streep called Defending Your Life?
Defending Your Life. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
This sounds a little bit like that, where he dies and then he goes to this bureaucracy and they essentially analyze you. It's almost like a little bit of a court hearing. But it's not a criminal court hearing. It's more like a custody hearing or something, where a tribunal looks at your life and you have an advocate. He has Rip Torn as his like supernatural lawyer. And, and again, it strikes me as like that whole, like, you're not quite human, but you're this other being, but you look like a human that our TVA employees are. And, you know, you've got to essentially prove that your life was meaningful enough that you get to move on to the next level. And that existence and the soul continues this journey into infinity, leveling up every time. And so if you're not If you just led a shabby life, you go back and you're reincarnated. And you can go to the Past Lives Pavilion and check out your existence. And I feel like a little bit of this show, the way we're hearing it described, brings that up. The bureaucracy, the supernatural, fused with the supernatural, the notion of, like, this is your life a little bit. Stepping out and examining the whole thing from beginning to end and how you lived it. So I gather he didn't cite that as a reference, but it sounds a little bit like that to me.
No, I think that's a great reference to note. A great film to watch too.
Nice thing about Albert Brooks is he has not become problematic, and so we can still enjoy his movies.
Though some of his movies, like Modern, I tried to watch Modern Romance, I think. I tried to watch an Albert Brooks movie on the Criterion Channel recently, and I was like, "Ooh, this is a no for me."
Oh,
I love a lot of Albert Brooks, but some of it has not aged super well. Anyway, one thing that I am gonna continue to try to wrap my head around is the fact that Waldron cited Steve Jobs as sort of someone that he connected to Loki. He was like, they were both orphans. They both like control. I don't know. I'm gonna think about that one a little longer. Yeah. The other reference he made,
disruptors of some sort,
that I hope you'll like, is he likened Doctor Strange to Anthony Bourdain, which I thought was really interesting. So that's a little peek into his take on Strange for the new Strange film. So, but yeah, Steve Jobs. Let's just continue to think about that as we go forward. All right, we're at the TVA. We're talking about time travel. Let's talk about how this show could possibly affect things going forward. We got an email from a listener who said that they weren't really fond about the way in which these shows have to sort of heavily lift other Marvel properties, that WandaVision becomes like a prequel for Doctor Strange or et cetera, et cetera. I think what these shows will always continue to do. And I think hopefully they will only get more graceful with that.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about Kang the Conqueror. Is there anything you can tell me about Kang the Conqueror, Anthony Bresnikan?
Well, we get another connection here to Lovecraft Country. So with Jonathan Majors, he's been cast as that part in the Ant-Man film, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Quantumania?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's a big bad in the Marvel Universe, one of the biggest bads there is. And interesting casting, like compelling casting, because I think Jonathan Majors is such a likable and you connect with him as a performer, like you root for him. So to cast him as the villain, that's like, again, it's like just casting a leading man as the bad guy. That's an interesting choice. So I'm kind of compelled to see, or I'm curious to see how exactly they do this. So the other thing about Kang the Conqueror is, he is known as a Nexus being in Marvel lore, and the Nexus is what was opened up in WandaVision. And she dreamed about it, or in one of those commercials,
right?
That were in the series, and the Nexus, of course, is just like infinite doors to different realities, and so Kang is one of the people who can traverse this, as is Wanda Maximoff. And a number of other characters. And these are characters who, I believe I'm describing this right, exist in every timeline. That in some, you go into some timelines and Anthony and Joanna don't exist there. But we're in others. But Nexus beings exist in every single timeline. They are consistent throughout that. Every
door you open. I think they're also same. I think they're also, I could be wrong, but I think they're also the same in every timeline. So you wouldn't get a Lady Kang. Right?
Yeah.
Like like the time branches could give you different flavors of Loki, but Kang and Wanda would be eternally Kang and Wanda in all these different branches.
Yes. They're the thread that runs through all of
right.
that. And so right. it's the same thread. And that's what makes them unique, but also very powerful and also very rare.
So the reason we're talking about Kang here in Loki is Kang is a well-known time traveler. A breaker of continuity, and a foe of the TVA in the comics. There are some theories that he might actually be one of the, like, time... Oh, I don't know what they're called. Time something in the TVA. There's these three statues that Time you see cops. In the trailer. These three statues and these basically the founders of the TVA. These three statues, these three faces that you see sort of a couple different times, a couple different places. And in the comics, there are these like three founders of the TVA or whatever. Kang is not one of them in the comics. But some folks have noticed that the card features of one of the statues bears a resemblance to Jonathan Majors' handsome visage. So it is possible that Kang is somehow involved. I'm not saying Jonathan Majors is going to show up, but like that Kang is somehow involved. And the other connection, the big connection, is that Gugu Mbatha's Ra's character, Ravona Renslayer, that's the name of Kang's like great love. In the comics, that he, you know, traveled through time and space and whatever to make it work with this woman. So, I mean, Gugu Mbatha Ra and Jonathan Majors, yes, please give it to me. I would love that. So, that might be a connection that we see sort of springing forward, Ant-Man, and something that Waldron talked about is because Jeff Loveness, his former Rick and Morty co-writer, was working on Ant-Man, they were sort of in conversation as they developed these things. They were talking because they're friends, right? They're both friends who get hired by Marvel from the same show around the same time. Of course, you're going to be talking and being like, oh my God, did they tell you that? Did they ask you to do that? You know, and so like, there's a bit of a spirit of and I think Jeff told me that Waldron helped him on his Ant-Man pitch. So there's just a spirit of collaboration there. The other spirit of collaboration that Waldron told me is that when he was working on Loki, he was right next to the WandaVision writers room in the Marvel offices. He became really good friends with Jack Schaefer, who is the head writer of WandaVision. And so, as he pops forward to Doctor Strange 2, he was like, I'm scooping up Wanda from Jack and running forward with Wanda. And I have this like, personal stakes in this because I don't want to disappoint my friend with what she set up with Wanda Maximoff. So I'm scooping her up and taking her into Doctor Strange. And I thought that was really interesting.
I like that. Friendly rivalries can be such a good thing. Productive for creative.
But also like a friendly collaboration. You know what I mean? And something that he said, Waldron said in the interview, is he's like something about, well, Marvel handing the ball off, right? Like, because he was talking about how they talk about time travel in Endgame and how they have to take that conception of time travel and Endgame into consideration as they consider time travel in this show, right? But he was talking about how, like, you create a disaster in Loki, and we'll leave that for the next writers. But then you go from Loki to writing Doctor Strange and you have to clean up your own mess, is what he said. So, like, there's definitely, like, a through line of, like, whatever's happening with time branching and reality branching in Loki is going to feed directly into Doctor Strange 2. But the good news is it's the same writer on both things. So hopefully there will be a lot of connective tissue there. So that's the thing. All right, last forward-looking thing. What are we always on the lookout for, Anthony Bresnikan, in these Disney Plus shows? It is the youth, the kids.
The next generation.
The next generation. We've been talking about the Young Avengers nonstop. Mm-hmm. Who are some of the other Young Avengers that we've talked about, Rez?
Yeah, some of the Young Avengers that we've already seen turned up in WandaVision. Her children, her two sons, who vanished. I don't know where, into the Nexus. They just disappeared. They were taken away and need to be rescued. They're two important key members of the Young Avengers, Wiccan and Speed. We also saw Eli Bradley, who was Isaiah Bradley's grandson in The Falcon and Winter Soldier. Didn't get a lot of screen time, but that's a character who steps up and takes on a Captain America-ish sounding name of the Patriot. And, so then Kid Loki also gets in on the action, right? So that's where we might see a little bit of this.
Yeah. So if there's a young actor playing a Kid Loki in this show that seems really fun and you might want to see him again, you might see him in some big Young Avengers team up. Like we said, we don't know. It's not been announced, but they really are seeding all of these characters into the Disney Plus shows. And it's, you know, can't ignore it.
And there's another one that's coming up, Kate Bishop in Hawkeye. She, you know, fights under the name Hawkeye. She assumes the mantle of Hawkeye. We've talked about that phenomenon happening a lot in the Marvel universe. And Hailee Steinfeld is playing her in the upcoming Hawkeye series.
Correct. So, you know, and America Chavez, Miss Marvel, you know, like there's all sorts of options coming up. So, you know, just keep your eye on the youth of Disney Plus. All right. Last thing I'll say is that I believe Loki's going to show up in Thor: Love and Thunder. So, you know, that's another thing to a branch to look for. But those are our branches, and they all seem like things that could happen a little bit more organically than maybe some of the stuff we saw happen elsewhere. And I'm just hoping that Marvel will continue to learn to make this feel more deftly part of a bigger tapestry than, you know, I think the worst example in the films is Ultron, which has some super clunky lifts to offshoots like Ragnarok, you know, like all the Thor stuff in Ultron is pretty clunky and stuff like that, right? So I just think, but then eventually I think they get a little bit more graceful, and I'm hoping they'll get more graceful with the TV shows as well. Last thing I want to talk about, which is just like some fun little minutia stuff from the trailer, stuff to get excited for. This is a time heisty kind of time hoppy Doctor Who-y kind of show, which means we're going to be like hopping around in time. There's this big elevator in the trailers that appears to be like how they portal through time, which is very, very Doctor Who TARDIS, very Bill and Ted phone booth sort of thing. And then we've seen some things. We've seen D.B. Cooper, which is a 1971 real life unsolved mystery, which was referenced in Mad Men. Like a lot of people thought John Draper was D.B. Cooper or whatever.
Yeah. So D.B. Cooper staged a heist on an airplane, took a bunch of cash, jumped out of the airplane, was never seen or heard from again. So people don't know, did he die? What happened to the money? Did he survive and make it out? Big mystery.
And in the trailer, like, Loki is D.B. Cooper, and as he hops out of the plane, he gets, like, zapped out of the sky by the rainbow bridge. Like, Heimdall, like, saps him out of the sky. That's what happened to D.B. Cooper. It was Loki. Like, that's the fun answer there. We also see him in the trailer.
It was Agatha all along.
Exactly. And, like, we see him in the trailer in Pompeii, and there's this cool, like, Seder Square mystery of Pompeii that you can look up that I imagine will be, like, I think they're going to just pop him into, like, various historical unsolved mysteries. You know.
We can get Robert Stack turning up at
it. Like, I don't know, you know, like, it's just going to be, I think they're just going to have a lot of fun.
In the 80s, he will keep Robert Stack gainfully employed on his hit NBC show, Unsolved Mysteries.
Unsolved Mysteries. It was Loki all along. The last thing I'll say is something you might have seen in the trailer is this branching timeline image, which is in the most recent trailer. And when I asked Waldron, you guys will have heard it, but I will just like confirm. When I asked Waldron, you know, I've asked all these head writers sort of like what was posted up in their writer's room. And Malcolm Spellman said, you know, it was the speech from the end of Black Panther, right? Killmonger's speech. For Waldron, it was these branching timeline images. And he was like, we were constantly looking at them, interrogating them, trying to play the Reddit nerds ourselves, essentially, so that no one would be able to catch us out in an inconsistency week to week. So Waldron is aware that we will be analyzing this time travel show to death week to week. So he has done his best to keep it consistent for all of us. We shall
and
see.
Nobody who makes anything that has to do with time travel ever steps out of line. That's the toughest thing. Just like built in with paradoxes.
Totally. He was like, I'm so jealous of the Endgame writers, basically, right? Because they got to do time travel. But then, like, you walk out of Endgame and, like, the number one thing you're focusing on is not going to be the time travel paradox. Eventually, we got there. A lot of people like to talk about the time travel paradox of Avengers Endgame. But, like, mostly you walk out, you're like, oh, you know, Natasha and Tony. You know, like, you're filled with a lot of other stuff. And then once your brain starts cooking, and he was like, we won't have that. It'll be week to week, cooking brains, looking at our time travel. So that's what we'll be doing here on the Still Watching podcast, where you can email us your nitpicks with the time travel logic, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, and anything else you might want to send over.
And we'll cook your brain.
That sounds good. Anthony Breznican, is there anything else we want to say before we head out?
I'm just dying to watch it. I think that's...
It's exciting, right? It's going to be really fun, I think. So I'm thrilled. So that is our Loki preview. We will be back next week with Richard Lawson, with, I believe, Tom Hiddleston himself also on this podcast on Thursday next week.
Making promises. Big promises.
I don't usually like to promise, but I'm pretty sure that one's in the bag.
It's a good
one.
Tom
Hiddleston, talk about episode one of Loki next week. And if not, y'all can email me at stillwatchingpod for breaking my promise to you. Anthony Bresnikan, until then, where can folks find you?
You can find me on vanityfair.com and my personal blog, 101 Ways to Cook a Brain. .net.
You can also
it's kind of recipes and, you know, philosophy. Kind of combined.
You can also find me rewatching episodes of Abbott and Costello to try to make sure I understand all of Anthony's references. Crying Tears in the Rain. Abbott, also find me.
Abbott was the straight man. Costello was the wild card.
You can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, and we will see you all next week.
Bye.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's five policemen outside and two policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.